All right, listen very carefully. Did you hear that? I know you're thinking it's a trick. There's no sound there. There wasn't. But my next guest says there's a treasure of unheard sounds all around us if we tune our ears right. He's traveled the world pulling sounds from some of the most unlikely places. Like, did you know that sand dunes can actually burp? Or that the great Mayan pyramids chirp? Trevor Cox is author of The Sound Book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. He's also a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in Salford, England. And if you have a favorite sound, do you have one? Perhaps the weirdest sound you've ever heard? Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I, and tell us about the weirdest sound. Maybe we'll find a way that you can send us that sound. And we can put it on our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest, Trevor. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you have spent your whole life going around the world collecting natural sounds.
Well, actually, I haven't spent my whole life. I started a couple of years back. It happened. I was in all places of a sewer, listening to the acoustics of a sewer, and I sort of kind of came up with this idea that maybe I should look for the most remarkable sounds in the world and celebrate them.
You just happened to be in a sewer.
Yeah, I was doing a radio interview about the acoustics of a sewer. I didn't really particularly want to go. It's not a very nice place, obviously. And I heard this amazing spiralling sound in there. This is a cylindrical sewer, and the sound will stick to the inside of the bricks, a bit like sound goes around the inside of a whispering gallery. It sticks to the inside of the curve. So I had this amazing spiralling effect, and it made me think, I wonder what other sounds are out there that I've kind of been ignoring.
Yeah, well, reading in your book about the Whispering Gallery, what is it about sound that it likes to stick to the walls of things and travel around?
Yeah, it's something which was worked out over 100 years ago by Lord Rayleigh. And if you imagine you had a circular sort of pool table and you just played a pool ball around the corner, skimming along the side, you'll find that it bounces off and it'll actually keep around the edge. It won't go in the middle. So it's just about how the angles of the pool table are. And so it's just a sort of quirk of geometry. And it means in, say, the Whispering Gallery at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, which is in the big dome there, you can whisper to your friend who might be 100 feet away across the other side of the dome and just use the wall to communicate with them.
Yeah, let's go look. We have a whole bunch of your sounds that you were good enough to send us, and then we can have our listeners listen to them. You recorded the world's longest reverberation. Before we hear it, tell us a little about where you found it and what did it sound like there.
Yeah, well, this is quite an amazing place. It's actually in an oil tank, a concrete-lined oil tank, which is buried in the side of a Scottish hill. And it was built there late 30s, early 1940s to protect the shipping oil from World War II bombing from the Germans. And to actually get in there, there's no door. You have to go down the pipes. And once you're in there, there isn't much else apart from sort of remains of shipping oil and this just huge sort of cavernous space made out of concrete.
Wow. Okay, let's listen to that sound now. That keeps going on, doesn't it, Trevor?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite amazing when I was in the space because I was up there with the recorder and I could see the clock counting up and up and up. That recording's about 70, 80 seconds long before I couldn't hear it anymore. And actually, remarkably, at low frequency, it was still going, but it dropped below the threshold of my hearing, but my mic was still picking it up, so I should have made the recording another 30 seconds longer.
What is the difference between a reverberation and an echo?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because actually I've got a Guinness World Record for that place now and they call it the longest echo, but it's a bit rankles an acoustic engineer because that's reverberation. So in acoustic engineering, an echo is when you hear a distinct second effect. It's where you go, you know, echo, echo. You can hear two distinct events. Whereas reverberation is that general mush you get, you know, the sound just generally decaying away. You know, notice it on that recording, but you'll notice it in churches and concert halls where you can't hear individual reflections, but you can hear a sense of sound just decaying away.
Have you recorded echoes?
Yeah, I went looking for echoes as well. Some of the best echoes come about actually if you find curved spaces and come near their focal point. So there was a listening station up in Germany, an old world, Cold War listening station, which has a radome on top. So radomes are these protective domes that are put on top of listening equipment. And it's a spherical room. which has the most amazing acoustics because you have the sounds being focused and ricocheting back and forth.
Wow. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Trevor Cox, author of the sound book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. He's a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in Salford, England. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry and go to our website at sciencefriday.com. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Trevor Cox, author of the sound book, The Science of the Sonic World. I'll try that again. The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World, also professor of acoustic engineering, University of Salford in Salford, England. One of the most interesting sounds in your book, and that we're going to feature and talk about now, is you traveled to the Mojave Desert to record sound in sand dunes. How do sand dunes make sound?
Well, you have to find the right ones, and actually in Southwest America, you've got quite a few which make this sound. And it's been known about for many centuries. I mean, Marco Polo, and there's ancient Chinese writings about these. It's when you create an avalanche is when you get the droning sound that people talk about. But you also get this weird sound when you just walk on these particular dunes that they make what you described earlier on as a burping sound.
All right, let's listen to that sound now. So those were your footsteps and the burping sound? Wow.
Yeah, that's me trying to climb up the dune. It's quite hard work. You need a very peculiar set of circumstances for a dune to do this, which is the reason there's not very many in the world which do it. The grains all have to be roughly the same size. So when the grains of sand are picked up from the desert and dumped, they have to be sifted so they're roughly the right size by the winds. They have to be really free-flowing and dry. So you have to go in the summer, the heat of the summer, to go and hear these. They have to have the right varnish of them, and they have to be roughly spherical. So there's a whole sort of combination of things that have to be just right for you to get that sound when you walk on it. But the famous sound is the one you get when you sit on your backside and create an avalanche.
This is winter time, and there's a lot of snow and a lot of ice out there. What can our listeners do to go out and experiment with making some sounds in this weather?
Well, ice is the most amazing material for its, the vast sort of range of sounds. You can get carving glaciers if you're lucky to be up near a glacier. But even something humble like a frozen lake is the most amazing sounds. If you just throw a rock onto a frozen lake, you'll hear it twanging. You'll hear a descending pitch. And it's because essentially what happens is the different frequencies move at different speeds within the ice. And therefore you get this sort of dwing, dwing, dwing sound as you sort of skim a rock onto the ice.
Some people describe walking on a lake as hearing a gunshot.
Yeah, like inside a room, if you create a sort of clap your hands, you'll hear the sound bouncing around. Within the ice of the lake, you can get sound bouncing around. So it's like a reverberation. It's like that reverberation we heard earlier on, but it's just in the ice. So, yes, yeah, so as ice on lakes cools down and warms up at the start and the end of days, you get these cracking sounds and these groaning sounds going on as well.
Let's move on to your chirping Mayan pyramids. What do you mean they chirp?
Well, it's a quirk of geometry, but the interesting and intriguing thing is the suggestion that maybe this was done, was used as part of the Mayan sort of ceremonies. They used to summon the Quetzal bird by clapping their hands. And if you just stand in front of the staircase, in front of a Mayan pyramid, and clap your hands, you'll hear that the sound will actually, again, it will go down in pitch. You hear it sort of dropping by about an octave. And it's just geometry. If you work out the distance from you to the stair treads and back again, you find that early on in that chirp, the sounds are arriving quite close together in time, and later on they're spaced out about twice the distance in time, which means the frequency drops. So it's all just down to geometry. But the intriguing thing is whether this helps explain some archaeoacoustics.
All right, let's listen to the Mayan pyramid. And that was just from clapping your hands and that little ping happened.
Yeah, later. if you go there as a tourist, the tourist guides will sort of encourage you to clap your hands. It's something that you can go on YouTube and see loads of videos because it's a sort of there's a story you get told when you go and visit those places.
Mm-hmm. How do you find these places? Do people say to you, "Hey, I know an interesting place. Take your microphone and take a hike."
Yeah, essentially. I set up a website which was called sonicwonders.org when I first had this idea. And it's, you know, it's labeled as a travel guide to sand, and people started making suggestions there. And it was only a bit later on that I then collated this into an idea for a book. But I would go along to acoustic conferences and then go and sort of give a lecture and say, come and give me some ideas, guys. And people would send me ideas to go and visit.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. And a lot of people have some sounds. I'd like to talk about them. Let's go to David in Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, guys. Love the topic. It's actually Beaufort, South Carolina, but that's all right. I had a quick story and a real quick question after that. Last night, actually, that's why this topic is fantastic here today. We have a farm here with a pretty large fishing pond, and I walked out right about sunset yesterday. And I guess I'd never been out there at that particular time of day before, but the soundscape was frankly overwhelming. There were so many crickets chirping, so many frogs. I heard ducks. I heard so many other birds in the background. And I've taken photography before, but just the image of that with the soundscape that I heard around me just frankly blew me away. My question would be, how common is it in nature for, like, for example, if I'd walked along that same path about 2 hours ago, I would have heard nothing, yet I walk out at sunset and there's that. So how do soundscapes change throughout the day in nature? And I want to know if they're using those sounds in the afternoon to communicate, or is it related to mating or whatever? I'm just really interested in the topic, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, David, thanks for calling. Trevor, what do you think?
Yeah.
Does it make a difference to the time of the day about how sounds are carried or what you'll hear?
Well, certainly animals call at different times of the day. And we all know this from birdsong that, you know, the dawn chorus is the time to go and hear the birds. So, yeah, animals tend to find their little niches to call in. So there's no point in them calling if they're going to be drowned out by other species. They all find their little niches to work in. Mm-hmm. And that includes finding the right time of day to make the sounds. And I guess they've got to weigh up the balance. If you're making sounds during the day, if they're vulnerable to predators, that's not a good idea. So maybe it's better to make it at night when they're a bit more safe. So there's issues about when they decide to do it. And there's a huge variety of animal sounds, as your listener was saying.
Yeah. Let's just go in the opposite direction, because I know you're an acoustic engineer, and so you do a lot of research in a soundless chamber, anechoic chamber, where I've been in these chambers. It's spooky to be in a completely quiet room.
Yeah, they're very strange places for a couple of reasons. First of all, they are the quietest places you'll ever go in. And they're buildings within buildings. So you walk in through an R1 at Salford, there's three sets of doors you have to go in to get into them. So first of all, any sounds you hear are only what you generate. So you might hear the sound of you breathing, and if you hold your breath, you then might hear the blood pumping in your head. And then you might also have the sound of some hissing around, and that's thought to be due to spontaneous firings on the auditory nerve. So there's a variety of odd sounds you hear in there you're not expecting to hear, because normally they're drowned out by everyday life. And then the other weird thing is, when you talk in here, your voice in those places, your voice sounds really muffled. And it's because all the walls, the floor and the ceiling are covered in absorbance, so there's no reflections. And that actually leads to people actually wanting to leave. And I think it's because people get this thing where they can see a room but they can't hear it, and they complain of being a bit queasy, unsettled, a bit like they're travel sick. And there are a certain number of people who will go in there and say, I don't like this, can I go out now?
Yeah, and in fact, just to give people some idea of how that muffling is possible, we have a sound that you gave us of a gun being fired in that room. Let's play that. Can you play that again? What? Doesn't sound at all like a gun.
Yeah, when I recorded that, it was quite funny, because I thought, maybe I've got the recorder wrong. I went and did it again, because, you know, I thought I must have got the settings wrong. A balloon burst in there is quite funny as well. It's just like foot, and it's done. Yeah, you're so used to hearing all these sounds within a room that hearing it without reflections is really quite alien. And, I think it's quite spectacular, that sound, in a sense, but in a sort of kind of underwhelming way.
And there's a lot of work that goes into soundproofing and sound shaping. For example, theaters and concert halls and... I've heard that even in a concert hall, in the old days when they would design one, that there's something called reverberation time, about how long it takes the sound to reverberate, and they shoot a cannon off, a little baby cannon off, and listen to the reverberation. Is that true?
Yeah. I've never heard people using a cannon. I mean, a starting pistol is quite common. What you heard there was a pistol firing blanks. And that's what we used in that giant oil depot we heard earlier on. That was a starting pistol being fired in there. And it's a really quick way of making a measurement. So it's particularly useful if you're measuring a concert hall when there's an audience there. Yeah. And we have other ways of testing, which involves playing strange beeps and whistles and noises. But the audience tends to get a bit annoyed by that. So it's much easier to go in there and say, can you just be quiet for a bit, and fire a gun off, and then they're done with their measurements.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people would like to talk about sound. Let's see if we can get somebody from Cleveland. Joe from Cleveland, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks
there
for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I am a classical musician, and we're always working to be more resonant. And I, from what I understand, that comes from the alignment of harmonics acoustically. How and why does that happen sometimes and not other times?
Do you mean when you're playing in a group, or do you mean when you're playing on your own?
On your own, like with a wind instrument or a violin, sometimes there's more ring, and from what I understand, that's from the aligning harmonics, and sometimes that ring doesn't happen.
Yeah, I'm a musician myself. I play the saxophone, but only as an amateur. And yes, there's all sorts of things going on when you change the sound. And I whether it's just aligning of harmonics, it might be a whole host of kind of things going on to give you that sort of perfect sound that you're looking for. But essentially, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make the richest sound that you can. And there's a variety of techniques.
Right.
One of the techniques you might use, I mean, as a saxophonist, I use vibrato. That's one way of giving a sort of human quality to the sound. As normally when we sing, we add a bit of vibrato. So that's about tweaking around with the harmonics. They don't all stay the same. They just warble a little bit, like as would happen if you just burst into song.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for calling. Good luck. Good luck in your music. One last sound we have here, very interesting sound, is called the musical road. And there are musical roads. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's about a dozen across in Japan. There's one in Korea, but you have one in America. I think it's the only one in the West that I know of, certainly. And it's in California. And, it's a road which plays tunes, but it's not electronic or anything. It plays tunes because it's got bumps in the road, or grooves, to be accurate. And as you drive over these grooves, you get a buzz. And where the grooves are spaced far apart, you get a low note. And when they're spaced close together, you get a high note. And so this musical road has these patches of grooves at different spaces and attempts to play a tune. I don't know if your listeners will recognize or not.
All right, we'll find out, because we're going to play that now and see if you can recognize this tune. It's Hyo Silver.
it's rather a flat rendition of it. It's
William Tell Overture.
Yeah, it's the Gallop from the William Tell Overture. It's quite funny, though, because it's actually very out of tune. But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They got the groove spacing wrong for some of the notes. So the top note should be an octave above the lower note in terms of the pitch. So it should be at twice the frequency. But it's not. It's not quite there. So to a musician, it's a bit painful. But it's quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, you have to drive over at just the right speed.
I strongly recommend using cruise control. Then you can have a nice constant speed, because the speed of your car changes the frequency as well.
Right.
If you speed up, it's going to go, you're going to get a higher pitch. So you want a nice constant speed, so use cruise control is my recommendation.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Trevor Cox, author of a great book. If you're ever interested in sound, the sound book, The Science of the Sonic Wonders of the World. Is there a sound that you still haven't gotten yet that you'd like to get and it's hard to find?
Yeah, I've had quite a few suggestions. There's actually one which I'd like to go and experience, but I've seen on video, and that's the lyrebird. So this is an amazing mimicking bird across in Australia what makes it really remarkable is not only does it mimic the other animals which you might expect, like the whitbird and the kookaburra, but it also impersonates those man-made sounds. So it impersonates camera shutters and chainsaws and car alarms and everything else it's heard as well.
Mm.
And I'd love to go and hear that firsthand, but the only time I went to Australia, I never went and saw it. So that's on my sort of list to do.
Yeah, it's a good reason to go there. A question about, I mentioned in the open, the car door slam. What makes that such a satisfying sound, a good one?
A because car manufacturers have spent a lot of effort making it sound satisfying for you. A few years back, maybe about 10 years ago, they realized that the sound was getting very tinny. What was happening was they were taking weight out of all the lock mechanism in the car door to save weight, because they were having to put roll bars in and other stuff, which was meaning they had to get weight from somewhere. And it made the door sort of kind of come home with a sort of clank, and it sort of sounded cheap and nasty. And if you're buying a car, the first point, the first sound you hear of the car is the car door opening and closing in the showroom. You don't hear the engine until you've actually been in the car in the showroom. Mm-hmm. So they spent a lot of time engineering and finding out what would make it sound better. So things which are low frequency tend to sound better made because they're more solid things. So they put some absorbent in the car door, actually in the cavity, to get rid of the high frequencies. And they also make sure all the mechanism closes as one, so it gives that very satisfying clunk.
Wow, they thought they put a lot of work into that. It makes sense, I guess, if you're not driving the car yet and you want a positive experience.
Yeah, they also look at things like the touch and the feel of all the buttons on the dashboard, because that's the other thing you touch when you get first in the car. And, you know, how does the ratchet on the seat sound when you move it back? Because, of course, when you first sit in the car, you have to adjust it to fit. So there's a lot of work put into getting that car sold to you.
When I first started out in radio, way before you were born, I used to experiment with something called binaural recording, where you put two microphones equally apart, like the space of your head. You walk around. It's not quite stereo. Have you ever done any of that? Experimented with that?
Yeah, we use it. It's a research tool that is still used today. So actually, I was helping some students out with our dummy head. So rather than just space two microphones out, you actually have a mannequin, really, which has microphones buried in the side of the head. And the idea of this is, ultimately, when we sort of in a space, all we have to tell what's going on is what's going down the ear canal. So if you put microphones where the ear canals are, you can pick up a perfect rendition of the sound field. The thing which makes it difficult is that everyone's heads is slightly different shape and sizes. So that means that it doesn't kind of, we've got this mannequin, but if my head's a slightly different size than mannequin, when I play back these sounds, it doesn't quite work for me. So it's a technology which is old. It's, you know, late 60s, early 70s, but it's coming back into its own because everyone's wearing headphones nowadays.
That's right. And when you play it back, it's just spooky. You know, it's like you're really there.
Yeah, if you get it right, if you get a really good recording, for some people it doesn't kind of work, but some people when it does work, it's really amazing because the sound is no longer in your head. When you listen to music on your MP3 player, the musicians are playing inside your head, but a proper binaural recording, it sounds like musicians are back outside again where they should be.
Do you think the sound has been degraded because of digital? Do you lament that?
I don't lament digital because I guess in a sense it's been a great sort of democratization of music. I mean, if I think about when I was a child, I had very few records. I had very little music I could actually own myself. Mm-hmm. And I look at my children now who've got their how many thousands of tracks on their MP3 players that they can share around. So I think digital has enabled an amazing sort of change to music, which I know the music industry has struggled with, but I think in many ways is to be celebrated.
You're not still listening on your old vacuum tubes, are you?
No, I'm very much in the digital age, though. My children did ask if I still had a record deck, and I had to admit I'd thrown it away, and they were rather taken aback.
Okay, yeah. They're still making vinyl now.
Right. In Britain, the vinyl sales are on the increase.
No kidding. That's fascinating. Trevor, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.